to you by our friends of the British Council.
To Rugby Wrap Up, Matt McCarthy at the Fantasy Sports Studio, Studio 34 at West 35th Street in New York City. I have some great guests today, including Mr. Mark Griffin of Play Rugby USA and Mr. Nick Murray, who I picked up in a bar, actually, but he is a security expert slash spy. He can kill you with a coaster, and he's also a rugby nut. And we have calling in the Englishman living in France, Mr. James Harrington, who is a pundit with Rugby Pass and ESPN Scrum. He's also been on Rugby Wrap-Up. And Mr. Ronan Nelson, who is a student and a pundit for Rugby Wrap-Up. Gentlemen, all welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Guys, we had Mr. George Hook on camera, and he was talking about Simon Zeebo earlier, and he said that the whole thing with Simon Zeebo was that he was actually posturing with his agent, and he'll never leave Ireland. We seem to think the guys here at this table, that he's gone. And I just wanted to know, Ronan, what you think about the Zeebo thing.
Well, regardless of whether or not it's posturing, I think it's the right time for Zeebo to move if he's going to move. He's been in his prime for a while now. He kind of came out of his shell when he had that match performance against New Zealand in Chicago. So if he's going to be able to move and get the most amount of money for his performances, it's now. He has family that's in France. His kids are young, so if he's going to move at any time, I believe that it's right now.
All right. James, what's your intel on Simon going over to France, and at what cost?
I agree. I think he's gone. The Munster seem to think he's gone. They announced that he's leaving at the end of the season, and Racing seem to be the club that he's going to. And if you look at the numbers, there's no great surprise there. According to figures I've seen, Munster were offering between 350 and 400,000 a year, and Racing are offering 700,000, a car and accommodation. So it's really no contest.
A car and accommodations.
Yeah.
It's a big car.
Wow. All right. Okay. How about parking? Because parking would be the deal breaker for me here in New York City. I would need parking.
Especially if you got your family in the car.
Right. All right. There we have it on Zeebo. Guys, I wanted to get your skinny on the Champions Cup. Give me your top three teams there, James, who you think are going to be the top three teams.
Saracens, for the title at the moment, they are by far and away the best team in Europe. Their doubleheader against Clermont in December is going to be a godsend, because it's the final all over again twice. So I've got Clermont as my other top team to watch, and also La Rochelle. They've been by far and away the most entertaining team in the top 14 for the past couple of seasons. And they are playing some joyous rugby.
Nick, what are the people in Ulster doing right now after that?
Well, I'd say they're particularly nervous getting ready to face Leinster with the weekend coming, given the form Leinster are in and the mauling, if you like, that they experienced unexpectedly previous weekends. So what's going on up there? Hard to say, really.
Coach in the hot seat?
I couldn't. Yeah, most certainly. I couldn't really comment on it. I have to confess, my knowledge of rugby up in Ulster is not as extensive as it would be for Leinster or Munster, but I would suggest that they're quite nervous. But then again, you have a wounded animal coming at you, they're going to throw everything, you know, come the weekend as well, which I think will make for a great match.
Ronan, your top three teams out of the Champions Cup.
Well, I agree with James in that La Rochelle is probably one of the best teams in the competition right now. They barnstormed Ulster. They were able to beat Quinns at the Stoop pretty handily. After that, I would say that Leinster is the next team to beat outside of that. They rolled past Glasgow at Scotstoun on Saturday, and Glasgow had come into the competition with 6 wins from 6 in the Pro 14. Leinster looked like they have control throughout all aspects of the match. Their defense was great, and most notably, their forward set pieces were absolutely a spectacle to watch. The third team that needs to be watched in this competition is Saracens. That doubleheader against Clermont is probably going to be the best thing for Northern Hemisphere rugby, at least for the clubs that's happened in a while. So if they're able to play well against Clermont, or if Clermont's able to play well against Saracens, it's going to be really, really big for how well French and English teams are going to do in the competition.
Mark, your favorite team is Leicester, right? The Tigers?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, and you're a Leinster guy.
Leinster man, yeah.
And with the, so we've got the battle of the I'm an LIE sandwich here. You think Saracens is going to take it?
I think Saracens are on such great form. They're such a fun team to watch. They've just got a great culture on that club, a bunch of young guys, and now some obviously got older guys that have been around for a long time. And they just seem to know when to put the toe to the metal, and they have the composure to get through rough parts and games as well. So I think I agree with these guys. I think the December games are going to be awesome.
Let me ask you this, though. If as an Englishman, if you had to pick between an Aviva Premiership Championship or a European Champions Cup for Saracens, what would you pick? Or for your Tigers?
If I'm Saracens, you just win both, right?
Well, last year they didn't.
No, I mean, look, I think it depends on... I think that the international aspect of the game is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and we were just talking about money in the game and broadcast and everything, and clearly that's showing that the international competitions of the top club franchises is the where things are going.
So,
right?
Mark, what would you rather have in your hands as a fan?
A Leicester Tigers Aviva Premiership winning team, and if Saracens win in Europe, good for them.
Okay. Mr. Harrington, why are the French so intent on ruining global rugby? They've got what? You said off camera to me that they're going to have what, 97 million in a TV
in
deal?
TV money.
But why not spread the wealth? Why not? Why isn't there some kind of global entity that ensures that this doesn't happen? We're pillaging nations here. The French are pillaging, James.
The French are coming. They're rugby Vikings. Interestingly, they did say at the in their World Cup bid that if they get to win 23 World Cup, it will be the saviour of world rugby.
Now, how's that?
I don't know how true that is, and I'm not clever enough to work out why they think that is the case. But at the moment, it seems only the English RFU has the financial clout to withstand the pressure from the top 14.
It's absolutely crazy. But I suppose the rest of the world's going to try to have to catch up somehow. And the Pro 14 is struggling to do it, you know, with the addition of the two South African teams. But who knows how that's going to happen. Ronan, are the Russians going to take over rugby? Are they going to be the next Toulon in attracting players with tons of Russian money?
Unless Russia gets a Roman Abramovich kind of figure who went over and stimulated the English Premier League soccer market. Sorry for bringing soccer up. Unless they get some sort of oligarch to be able to back their teams there, I don't think they'll have any sort of big clout anytime soon. But the one thing they do have on their side is Siberia and the Russian winter. They're able to be able to play in these places that are absolutely formidable and horrible places to go and play your away trips in European competition. If you remember a few years ago, American International AJ McGinty going off and playing against NCASTM in Siberia in negative conditions outside. They only won that match because they were able to squeak over a try that had been knocked on because the ball was so icy that the Russian players weren't able to hold it. So I believe that's really their only advantage at the moment. They'll get better, but not just yet.
All right. Well, I think the Russians are coming, and I think the threat of Siberia is not only on the other players from the other teams, but it's on their own players in their own country. They say, okay, we'll play all our matches here in Siberia unless you start winning the games, and maybe we'll go to Moscow. And as James, you pointed out in a previous chat, that when they played in Moscow, what was that explanation? It was further for them to go for their home game, whatever it was.
It was Krasnoyar who beat Stade Francais in the opening round of the Challenge Cup. They played their first match in Siberia, but their second match against Edinburgh, it was technically a home game, but they had to travel to Moscow, which is further away for them as the home team to go to than it was for Edinburgh as the away team. It was about twice the distance.
All right, so we've got some problems, some global problems to solve, which was great for this show. We're going to take a quick break. I want you to stick around, and we're going to talk about some different stuff, some more rugby coming at you right after these words on Rugby Wrap-Up.
If you're in New York City and want to watch some great rugby, have some great food, and some great times, go to the world's best rugby pub. The Pig and Whistle on West 36th Street.
We're back with Mr. Mark Griffin, Mr. Nick Murray, Mr. Ronan Nelson, and Mr. James Harrington. So, Mark, CEO of and founder of Play Rugby USA.
Correct.
How long is that program going?
2006 is when I sort of quit the banking world and started dedicating myself to that full time, although we technically were founded in 2003.
So it's been a while.
Yeah, that's a solid 11 years and counting, yeah.
You know, the reason I bring it up is because whether it's non-profit or a non-for-profit, if that's what you call it, or not, you are in rugby business in America.
100%, yeah. I mean, in any one given year, we've got anywhere from 90 to 100 employees, including all of our hourly people. So we're very much in the business of rugby, albeit sort of in the educational sector.
Tell me about the state of the game in business and conducting business in rugby in the United States, Mark.
Yeah, I think obviously there's massive opportunity over here, and everybody's been talking about that for many years. And I think it's been very hard for any single one entity to really monetize that opportunity in a sustainable way. There's a number of great organizations out there that I think have made a really big impact on the game. Obviously, USA Rugby's been going for a very long time, sort of at the head of everything. The USA Sevens guys have done a great job elevating the game's profile, I think, on the, sort of the broadcast
stage.
You mean
the Vegas,
and major,
United World Sports Vegas and CRC and...
All of their franchises, yep. Their brands. And then obviously Dan with AEG now looking to sort of get that side of it going through big major events and stadia and experiences. And so the Atavis guys have done a great job in the game development side of things, taking on the sort of academy structures and the talent identification stuff. And I think that the challenge that everybody's faced is that as a single entity, without connecting the dots and collaborating across with other areas of the game, it makes it very, very hard to come up with a sustainable commercial structure, because at the end of the day, the game over here still isn't quite big enough for the big money. It's not quite big enough for the big TV, and we're just getting there now, right, with a lot of NBC's interest and broadcast. So I think the next 5 years are going to be instrumental. We've seen professional rugby come and go. We've seen false starts on professional rugby, but I believe that's going to change.
I want to touch upon that. Do you think the false starts in professional rugby were because they didn't reach out to the community, the youth, as much as they should have? Do you see that from your end?
I don't think that's the way I see the false starts. You can talk about false starts all the way back to 2001.
That's true.
Right? And that was probably a market-driven opportunity. There's been false starts just because people have come up with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business plans on a rugby market that's just nowhere near there.
$1 million sevens, filling the Superdome for a Canterbury Knights versus... I think Saracens match or something like,
you
know.
But to your point, I firmly believe in the rugby sector, but this would work in any sort of commercial sports entity, essentially, that just like companies that are very good at corporate social responsibility or even shared value solutions outside of sports, I think in the sports sector, that is a great lead for a league. It's a great lead for a club. It's a great league for a sport to show that they genuinely care about the impact of their sport. Not just they're passionate about the values of the game, but how are you taking those values of the game and putting them into the mainstream educational sector in the US, which, let's face it, is where all of the growth in rugby is, whether it's participation or fans that you're looking for. The rugby people are going to watch anyway. So the opportunity, the commercial opportunity, is to engage non-rugby people. And that's where I think if you can design programs like ours that enable rugby to become an educational solution, you make rugby a very, very popular vehicle for the educational sector. And that can get you the 50 to 75,000 kids in the US plus families involved in rugby.
I mean, I've seen firsthand some of the kids that are getting scholarships, some of the kids that are graduating college for the first times in their families because of Play Rugby USA, and then getting Ivy League scholarships.
Yeah, we've a couple of Ivy Leagues, and obviously we've got Jew up at
West Point.
And one of my proudest things is that we have over 20% of our staff, our coaching staff in New York, or what we call our youth development mentors. When you combine the coaching staff with the office staff, 20% of our staff have come through our program in New York. And that's a real testament to the power of rugby for them and how they took that on board, probably late on, as anywhere from 13 to 18, some of these guys started playing rugby, and yeah, already they're looking to give it back to their communities and make a career out of it, which I think is a fantastic testament to their dedication to the sport.
All right, so we're coming up on our first break, and we're going to be talking about some professional rugby overseas, but I wanted to get your take real fast on what's needed for pro rugby to succeed here in the United States as a businessman that's doing business here.
Look, I mean, for professional rugby to succeed in the United States, obviously, I believe there has to be a core community / CSR element that's actually at the core of the strategy.
CSR is communities.
Corporate social responsibility. Okay. That's a way to engage sponsors over and above levels that you could engage sponsors in, because brands want to be associated with social impact and social change. Yeah. They also want to be associated with a successful brand. So you need that at the core. You need, obviously, the broadcast helps you get the sponsors. You need bums on seats, as we've heard many times. And ultimately, you have to build, I think, clubs in the community that care, like differentiate rugby clubs from just sports teams, and what that means to be a club, to be a hub, to be somewhere where the community can really get involved and get an experience and feel that that club is making an impact on their community as well. And I think if you add all those things together, with obviously the appropriate amount of investment up front and a conservative enough plan to get to break even, you've got a shot.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how has the landscape changed from when you started to people actually starting to look like corporations and sponsors at rugby in the United States?
I think there's been a significant change in the last 4 or 5 years, but I think that that's accelerating. So I think we're very much at the bottom of the growth curve. Rugby participation has probably doubled since I've been here, but I've been here 18 years, right? So I don't think that's very impressive.
Right.
I think what will be impressive is if we can achieve 3 or 4-fold growth in the next 5 to 6 years, and along with that, all of the broadcasting and the sponsorship and everything, sure, I think really will come into play.
What are the real numbers on kids playing rugby in America? Do you have any ballpark? It's a tough thing to figure out.
That really is a USA rugby question. I don't have access to the membership data to know. I'm guessing 50,000 or so. We have 5,500 players in our program, but of that, probably 300 or 400 of them are directly registered as clubs under our umbrella with USA Rugby because they're playing in leagues. The others are in after-school programs as part of our youth services arm. Right. So, there's other programs like that around the country, I'm sure, that have probably a few more thousand kids that probably aren't captured in the numbers. But I would guess that it's somewhere from 50 to 70,000 kids in total.
All right. Well, keep doing what you're doing, because what you're doing is great, and it's a great service to the country and to the kids. I want to thank all of you for participating. It's been riveting. We could do this for hours, but we can't do it for hours because we're on a schedule here in the studio. But on behalf of Mr. Nick Murray, Mr. Mark Griffin, Mr. Ronan Nelson, and Mr. James Harrington, Matt McCarthy for Rugby Wrap-Up here at Studio 34, the Fantasy Sports Network, signing off.